excited to move on to our next speaker, Sean Faircloth. It is my distinct honor to be able to introduce him. He is the author of Attack of the Theocrats, How the Religious Right Harms Us All and What to Do About It, which is for sale out in the lobby. And you should pick up a copy, by the way. But prior to joining our movement, Sean was very active in the Maine House of Representatives for 10 years. And currently, he is the Director of Strategy and Policy for the Richard Dawkins Foundation for Science and Reason. And if you've never heard him speak before, buckle your proverbial seatbelts, because he's a really firebrand speaker, and I'm looking forward to hearing him talk again. So please welcome Sean Faircloth.
But actually, I will say that today I'm going to have a talk that's more about nuts and bolts and political strategy, so a little different from my typical talk, because we have some things to overcome, as we know here. In the state of Wisconsin, we have people like Paul Ryan, who says that his version of the budget is justified somehow by the Bible. I'd like someone who's theological to explain all that to me. It's also the state of Scott Walker, who says that he makes every decision in consultation with God. How's that going? Maybe he needs a different advisor, perhaps. I'm not sure where he's headed with that. But really, you know, their sort of forefather here in Wisconsin was a guy named Joseph McCarthy, who many of you may be familiar with. But that's one heritage of Wisconsin. We have another heritage here in the state of Wisconsin. One is the great skeptic Houdini from Wisconsin, Appleton, Wisconsin, who back in the day was really the original skeptic who really spoke out and spoke out against those who were using the so-called religion of spiritualism and really bilking people, and he advocated for laws to make lives better for people who were being conned by religious spiritualism. And it's also the state of Gene Wilder, a good Jewish boy. Yes. A proud Jewish boy. However, he says he is not religious at all and says that the only ethical value he has is the golden rule. And it's a good rule. And I'm glad it's in the Bible. It's one sentence in the Bible, but it's a very good sentence. You have to sort of ignore many other sentences in the Bible, but that is a good one. I will point out, however, that at least 5 centuries before Christ, the golden rule was offered by the Greek philosopher Pittacus. So it both precedes and the Bible is unrelated to the origin of the golden rule. But it is a very good rule, but sometimes science can often improve things. In fact, Linus Pauling, the 2-time Nobel Prize winner for science and for peace, he offered a sort of amendment to the golden rule, which I kind of like. Do unto others 20% better than you'd expect them to do unto you, to correct for subjective error. That one's always been a good one by me. And someone who lives with that spirit, the spirit of Houdini, the spirit of Gene Wilder, Wisconsin's own, is a guy not from Wisconsin, but a really terrific person who I have the pleasure to work for and with, Professor Richard Dawkins. There he is back in the 70s when he had that sort of cool Steve Jobs look going on. But he is a person that really stands for tremendous value, and I consider him really, despite all this talk, strident. What I find is a deeply passionate, caring, and decent man. But I'm actually going to talk about him in an interesting way as a resource, because I've had the pleasure of being sort of the opening act as a speaker for Richard Dawkins, which is sort of like being the opening act for the Stones. It's intimidating, trust me. But I'll tell you that we were at Eastern Kentucky University together. Have any of you heard of Eastern Kentucky University? I'd never heard of it before I went to Eastern Kentucky University. 2,300 people showed up to see Richard Dawkins at Eastern Kentucky University. And I really want to give you a sense of what this means, because our tagline at the Dawkins Foundation is innovating for a secular world, and that Richard Dawkins himself is a unique resource for innovating for a secular world. And I want to just describe a bit of what I mean about those 2,300 people in the state of Kentucky. Some context here. There are approximately 51 metropolitan areas in the United States that have 1 million people or more. You can recognize the skylines of a couple of those metropolitan areas. But down toward the very bottom, near the very bottom of this list of 51, is Louisville, Kentucky. Louisville's on the list. It's near the bottom, but it's on the list. And Louisville, Kentucky is 100 miles from Eastern Kentucky University. Yes. And this is a place that's really the true Bible Belt that we're talking about here. And furthermore, that the town, Richmond, where 2,300 people showed up, is not even in the top five population cities in Kentucky. So that is the kind of place where we went. And it really, I have to tell you, someone with a political background and political experience, this really was something that had an impact on me. Because I'll tell you, if Mitch McConnell, the powerful Republican senator from Kentucky, said, I'm showing up at Eastern Kentucky University, you're not going to see that crowd. I've been in politics 20 years. I served in 10 years in elective office myself. I was majority whip, so it was my job to help candidates, help with campaigns. And usually for a candidate, you have an advance team. You have people who are working to build a crowd. You sometimes are doing paid advertising. But in the case of Richard Dawkins, you basically kind of whispered out there, Richard Dawkins is coming. And 2,300 people show up in that area. And then furthermore, that in my opening remarks, it gets better. Because in my opening remarks, I give a 10-point vision of a secular America. And it is a very secular plan for America. And you know what we got in response in the so-called Bible Belt? 2,300 people cheering for an expressly secular America in this country. Richard Dawkins is a unique resource. And it has to do with what I've seen time and time again, where people walk up to him with a book in their hand and say, Richard Dawkins, you changed my life. I've been on two book tours now with him, and it's not once or twice. It's over and over again that people express this. And it's an electric emotion, and it can be transformational for us, for American society. And I want to talk about how we can do that. The mission of the Richard Dawkins Foundation, in part, is to, quote, overcome religious fundamentalism, superstition, intolerance, and suffering. And this mission must involve more activism. Not more activism from Richard Dawkins. He's already incredibly generous with his time. What I want to talk about is more activism from you, from everyone here in this room. Because sometimes I hear, not necessarily from people here, but I do hear it a lot of times when I travel around speaking on behalf of secular causes, I'll hear secular people say, well, you know, politics, it's a dirty business. You don't want to be involved. And having been in politics and seen what it's like, I can sympathize. I understand what you're saying. But one thing that I see is that, you know, when I was in elective office for 10 years and the religious right was lobbying me every day during those 10 years, and not once, not ever, not a single time, did someone come up to me and say, I'm with a secular person or an organization, I want you to vote this way on a bill. It never happened once. So that I commend the religious right, because they got organized and they have bootstrapped their way to fight way beyond their weight class. They're a minority. The moral majority is neither the majority nor moral, but they have managed to put themselves in a position unique in American history where they now have veto power over one of two major political parties in the United States, and it gives the appearance of equipoise in this country, and it was really successful. So whether we think it is a dirty business or not, we need to reach in and make a change in American society. And I talk in my book and at the Richard Dawkins Foundation about a secular decade plan, a strategic plan. It's not a secular 2 weeks, by the way. This is an investment of our lives and of our time. And I talk about this 10-point vision of a secular America. And when I talk about strategically, nuts and bolts, how we're going to get there. So innovating for a secular world. One, at the Richard Dawkins Foundation, is innovative issue framing. How do we frame our issues in a way that's going to make us successful in the common wheel in American politics today? Innovative organizing in the Richard Dawkins Foundation. And then third, getting to this last, an unparalleled catalyst for you, for your state, wherever you are and wherever you live. So in addressing this mission, I have to say that one strategy that I don't think works very well is just say no. You know, Nancy Reagan tried just say no. And I don't think it quite works. You know, saying just no to religion, where I might agree with that, I don't think it's enough for the general population, because I describe their brand, their religious right brand, as a beautiful brand, a seductive brand. They have the seductive simplicity of certainty, and it is great. It is the best marketing that Don Draper could ever come up with. It is well done, and it has been working for hundreds of years, and in recent decades working with increasing effectiveness. And I want to offer to you, you may not like it, but for your discussion and by way of example, I want to offer you a rhetorical framing, a rhetorical approach to our issues. Hopefully, the video will work here, and then I'll discuss it a bit afterwards. Let's see if we can get to the beginning of this video. That's not the beginning.
Our next speaker, folks, has been was a member of the Maine legislature for 10 years. He is also the author of Attack of the Theocrats, and he's currently the director of strategy and policy for the Richard Dawkins Foundation. You're in for a treat. This is one of the most entertaining and passionate speakers I have ever had the pleasure to listen to, Mr. Sean Faircloth. So, I'm a white guy with a tie, and I have more confessions. Yes, I have been a politician, a lawyer, and a lobbyist. But I'm here to say to the young people here that if there can be lawyers and lobbyists and politicians for injustice, you can be lawyers and lobbyists and politicians for justice, and I ask you to do it. I ask you to do it. I have another confession to make. I have to say that I have never in my life really experienced serious discrimination. Now, African Americans, we can think of unforgivable violations of their civil rights, including recently. Gay people, discrimination against them to this day. But I gotta tell you the truth. For me, like Bill Gates, not religious, like Warren Buffett, not religious, I'm doing just fine. Well, not just as fine as them, you know. So why am I here? I'm here to speak for fundamentalists. Yes, that's right. Or at least the children labeled fundamentalists who have their health and sometimes their very lives endangered by child protection laws weakened for so-called faith healing. Also, child care center laws weakened for religious child cares that even neglect children. I am here for more than a million girls in fundamentalist schools today who, based on a religious loophole in Title IX, could be taught in school in 2012 that women must be subordinate. Let's speak out for those girls. It's worth. I am here today for the fundamentalist who is fired from a taxpayer-funded faith-based initiative because they were the wrong type of fundamentalist. True story. It's wrong. We'll speak out for them. I'm here for the religious person going blind from macular degeneration whose eyesight might be saved if religion were not impeding stem cell research. We have to stand up for that now. I am here for those children in Texas and other states who are being told lies about history and science printed in taxpayer-funded textbooks. It's gonna stop. I am here for the Muslim taxpayer. I am here for the Jewish taxpayer, and I am here for the atheist taxpayer who has our tax money grabbed out of our pockets to subsidize the mansions of mega ministers who preach hate in every town in America. At the Richard Dawkins Foundation, at the Richard Dawkins Foundation for Reason and Science, U.S., we offer a 10-point vision of a secular America, or as I call it, a modest plan to take over the United States. But with our plan, it is not a plan to exclude, it is rather a plan to include, because we don't believe that any ancient document can deny any human being their human rights. Richard Dawkins asked me, he asked me to use my 20 years of experience in politics to organize in Sarah Palin's Alaska, and in Michelle Bachmann's Minnesota, and in Rick Santorum's Pennsylvania. And working with every one of you in every single state of the Union, we will bring back James Madison's Constitution. We will bring back Thomas Jefferson's First Amendment. And we will bring back Jack Kennedy's America, where in Jack Kennedy's words, and I quote, the separation of church and state is absolute. We stand for that America. I tell you today that I am devoting my life to our cause, and I ask you to devote yourselves to this cause in every single state working together, because we're not on a mission from God, but we are on a mission from Jefferson and Madison and Kennedy. We are. Together, we secular Americans are taking command of the moral high ground. We are taking the lead. And together, we are going to make a great nation even greater. Thank you very much.
What I want to talk to you about this speech is framing us and our brand as the tribunes of justice, and that we are the tribunes of justice. I think that in politics, and sometimes within the secular movement, I've seen similar trends where people kind of treat speeches as, well, something else that you do. We make the deals in the back rooms, we have all our meetings and so forth, and that speeches are kind of some kind of form of entertainment, which they should be, but that's all they are, and that we go to the speech and we come back and that's the end. I think speeches, and what FDR thought speeches were, is that they are a tool. They are a tool of framing political issues, and that being the tribunes of justice is an important frame for our issues. You'll notice when I was talking there that I spoke, we spoke, secularists spoke, for fundamentalists, for protecting the rights of fundamentalists, for children in fundamentalist homes, for minority religions, because then we are positioned, not only with ourselves, which I think is energizing, but also with the broader American audience, to many of whom we have a strong appeal to say, listen, we are the ones speaking on the vanguard of these justice issues, and draw people in that way that can have a human impact. I think that is critically important. The other thing that I do that I think is important for our movement is talk more about stories. To talk stories, because in our movement we have this noble flaw, everything must be data-driven. And it should be data-driven, I agree with that premise. But that telling stories, and I proudly will call them anecdotes, because I know anecdotal is not accepted within science. But what anecdotes are is opening that door. And I'm not going to go through the whole discussion of stories like I do on, I have another video on YouTube, Atheism, A New Strategy, and you can check out more detail there. But using storytelling as a tool to open the door for people to understand what our cause is about, and I don't think we do it enough. And when I talk about our brand, something that is deeply meaningful for me is that while I think the seductive simplicity of certainty is very seductive, and it works, that we do have a better brand. And that better brand is Here he is. There he is, Francis Bacon, who I think is one of the most awesome people in history, not just because of his clothes, by the way. I think they're very good. But this is the guy who wrote it. He put it together in 1620 in his book, The New Method. He's the guy that Thomas Jefferson put in a place of honor at Monticello, his bust, because he said it was Francis Bacon who was the first person. There were scientific people, of course, before Francis Bacon. But Francis Bacon was the person who articulated this vision. We're coming up on the 400th anniversary, that this is a way of viewing the world, the scientific method as a way of viewing the world. And this is the best cause in the entire history of our species. I'm lucky because a few weeks ago I got to sit at lunch with Richard Dawkins. A rat attacked us, came over and walked over our dinner there at lunch in Santa Barbara. But after that more scary part, Richard Dawkins was telling me a story about human history and then putting the analogy this way, that if you take the history of our species from your sternum and then measure out the whole history of our species, that the part that I would study in school about the Enlightenment and things like that, that's the shavings on the end of your fingernail in the course of human time. And that makes me so optimistic, because we have done fantastic things in this blip of less than 400 years. So rather than be discouraged about what we've achieved, I feel tremendously optimistic about what our brand offers. Because this method, the continuing quest of questioning, it is this method that makes me lucky to wake up every day, because I actually work and I'm paid to work for this cause. But we do have some branding issues, some marketing issues, because here's our friend again. But that, oh, there's the cold scientific approach. They're not compassionate. They're not nice. They don't really get it. It may not be a rational perspective, but it is one that is widely held and one that we need to consider and address. And part of it, part of the passion for it, part of the passion that can really help change it, and we should embrace that passion, is the ideas of a scientist named Jefferson. Because people view it, they say, oh, science is over here and politics is over there. Well, there's a lot of things, I would be the first to say, they're problematic about politics, but that's not the way Jefferson, a politician and scientist, saw it. He said the main objective of all science, the freedom and happiness of man, is the object of legitimate government. Freedom and happiness, that is the goal, and that we are the tribunes of justice who speak for that. And the point of the 10-point vision of a secular America is to frame issues in such a way that it welcomes people and introduces people to our cause in a way that draws people in rather than pushes them away. I'm not going to repeat the 10-point vision here. You can see it in the Atheism, a New Strategy video. What I want to talk to you today is the nuts and bolts of why. So why does this matter? One is that it offers a positive vision. In the 10-point vision of a secular America, we're not simply saying no to religion. We're saying here is this positive view of what America can be to make a great nation even greater. Secondly, it frames our vision as compassionate. Every single point in the 10-point vision has to do with addressing an injustice that hurts people, real live people, not symbolic issues, actual people harmed. It reframes the way we are perceived on this. Third, it demonstrates the pervasiveness of the problem. Because I've heard people say to me, well, Sean, why not just have 2 or 3 points because people can't remember 10? Wrong, and here's why. There's some great issues that we know about that are valid on our side. One is women's rights, and we need to always hold that issue high because it's so clear how religion oppresses women's rights. But it's also an issue that many other people, many other large organizations that have nothing to do with our cause bring up. Another one is the mistreatment of gay people. Another issue we should hold up and champion and always continue to do so. But there are other major organizations unrelated to our viewpoint that raise those issues. But when you look at the breadth of the 8 additional issues that I talk about and addressing those injustices, then it starts to sink in. Let the people themselves follow the lines down from the 10-point vision of a secular America and say, oh, what is that? What is the root cause of these problems? Oh, I see, and let people draw their own conclusion about where that problem comes from in American society. Also, fourth, it humanizes the non-religious. And we aren't the mean, cold, angry people. We are the people in every case in the 10-point vision of a secular America that are seeking compassion. Next, it puts fundamentalism on the defensive. We turn the tables on them and say, well, here's all these justice causes. Are you against them? Tell us why you are against them. Explain yourself to us, because we are the tribunes of justice. And then Christopher Hitchens said it. The thing he most wanted to see and achieve would be the separation of faith in people's minds from virtue. And when you go through the 10-point vision of a secular America, every single time it is reiterated that our position is the virtuous position, it is the compassionate position, and it takes that high ground that they must in turn attack. That's how we want to frame issues. We put together a video contest and came up with a promotion for it, for this 10-point vision, and I want to show that to you. It's only a minute and a half long. Hopefully I'll be able to figure out how to get back afterwards.
This is what I believe.
For sexual health and pregnancy, all options should be available, and we should be educated about them.
I believe our schools should teach an evidence-based education, uncolored by religious beliefs.
I believe our military should respect and include all our soldiers, religious and secular. And I am a Christian spiritualist American.
And I am a Jewish American.
And we're agnostic Americans.
I believe that we should welcome religious and secular political candidates.
I believe we should each choose how we face the end of our lives without the religious beliefs of others interfering. And I'm an agnostic American.
A spiritual American.
I believe having lower health standards for religious daycares and faith healing endangers the lives of all of our children.
I believe our tax dollars should only fund institutions that do not discriminate on the basis of religion. And I'm an atheist American.
An agnostic Buddhist American.
I believe our environmental policy should be based on scientific evidence.
I believe doctors should look beyond religious views to best address the needs of their patients.
I believe we should encourage and use scientific advancement without any limitation from religion. And I'm a Muslim American.
A secular Jewish American.
An atheist American.
I believe adults of all sexual orientations should have the same rights and privileges, and I'm a secular humanist American.
I believe many Americans share our views but remain silent.
Do you believe in a secular America?
So what we hope to achieve with that is a humanizing effect. That video, by the way, covered all 10 points of the secular vision for America. I talk about that in a much more detailed and academic way, backing it up with all the injustices that it addresses in my book. But this does it in a minute and a half in a way that I think is very effective, seductive in a way. And the seductive simplicity of certainty is something that we need to overcome, and I think that we haven't done enough in that regard. And I want to talk about that, about being persuasive, being seductive in the way that we approach our issues. Because it is a good thing to debate. I'm an attorney. I support it and think it's very valuable. You have people like JT and PZ and Matt Dillon Hunty who are extremely knowledgeable and effective, and we need to do more of that, not less, in terms of debating the merits of religion. That's a very important tool that we have. But an additional tool that we maybe have not utilized enough is the tool of welcoming people in and persuading them in a way that makes them feel comfortable with what goes on. You know, to bring the analogy somewhat here to folks who are in the college realm, I mean, when guys, you know, you guys are at the fraternity and you meet some young woman and say, you know, what's your major? You know, they may suspect that you're thinking more than about what their major is. And that's a good thing. They know, everybody knows who knows what. That's fine. That's all good. Because sometimes, under some approaches, that approach works better, and we ought to allow for that approach. I mean, there's the blatant approach that sometimes can be effective, but other times, let's turn the table and think how sometimes it's not effective. I mean, there are those who might be persuaded to come to Jesus. But if somebody's shouting at you at the street corner, think about how you feel sometimes, somebody's saying, come to Jesus, accept my religious viewpoint immediately. That sets people, some people, back in a way that might be persuasive by another method. And I think the religious groups have learned that, and we need to be more effective in that regard. So, you know, here I'd say something about male peacock feathers if I knew anything about that, but Richard Dawkins can do it. What I would say is that we need to understand that with societal mores, with the societal mores both about sexual issues and societal mores with regard to secularism, that there is a religious overlay. I think that religious overlay is wrong. I think that religious overlay is immoral, but it is an overlay that affects people so much and affects how they think so much that sometimes something that is a more subtle approach is one that we need to reach people with. It offers that sense of value and happiness where people say, oh, Jefferson, freedom and happiness, let's bring people in through that route, and that is the Tribune of Justice route. So that's one of a 1-2 punch, but there is a second part of that punch, and that is about the religio-industrial complex. And I use the term advisedly, the religio-industrial complex, because we're talking about an industry that has grown dramatically over the last 40 years. There were less than 100 defined megachurches in the United States in 1970. Now there are hundreds upon hundreds of these. And we're going to take the type of approach that you saw in that video, the uplifting approach, and talk about a 10-point vision in an expanded and documentary form. But then we're also going to talk about those who pervade the injustices that must be addressed by the 10-point vision, those who enrich themselves with it, who enrich themselves with the parsonage exemption that many secular Americans don't even know about, where taxpayers subsidize the homes of people like Mr. Osteen. He doesn't accept anymore because he got a publicist, but he used to use that tax exemption. The home of Joyce Meyer here. But more important than these two, who are famous, is the mega minister in Topeka, Kansas, that you've never heard of, who's enriching themselves now with the parsonage exemption, with our tax code, and with purveying the fundamentalist viewpoint about women, about gay people, that is so unjust, and to have it purveyed with your tax money, that's something that we need to address critically. So the lifestyles of the rich and famous would be another part of how we approach this issue, because there's good guys and there are people who aren't nice guys, and these folks are not being nice with how they are treating our fellow citizens. So the next in innovating for a secular world is your involvement, your direct involvement, that you make the 10-point vision a 10-point means. People here have the talent for that. And then most importantly, more importantly than anything else that you could do to help change America, is a statewide secular group and organizing for advocacy trainings. Why is this the single biggest thing you can do? Because remember, when I served 10 years in politics, the religious right lobbied me every single day. No one, no organization ever spoke to me on behalf of secularism. That change, this isn't to replace any local group in any state, far from it. It brings together the group, so you can have those who are the, you know, Marine Corps of atheism, the more confrontational groups, and you can have the more accommodationist groups, because they all agree on separation of church, a church and state, a statewide policy-focused organization. And when I proposed this idea 2 years ago, I had people say to me, well, that's an unrealistic idea, except that not only is it succeeding in Arizona, they not only already have a statewide secular organization, they kicked it off with an elected official in attendance for their statewide secular organization, and they went way beyond what I proposed and raised enough money so they now have a lobbyist in the state capitol in Arizona speaking out for secular values. We're going to have that in every single state of the union by the year 2020, and I'm going to work with you to get that done. And really, do the people in the state of Wisconsin want to be behind Arizona on this? I mean, come on. State of Alabama has a statewide group. You in this room can get this done, and I want to talk to you about specifics, about how you need to take action to get this done, whether you're in this room or whether you're watching online. You need to work with that 10-point vision. Inform yourself about it, talk about it to others, make it a meme. Then organize that group. Someone in this room, many people in this room, could be part of a team that creates a statewide secular organization. There are people who are web savvy in this room who can help create that statewide group. And there are people in this room who can raise money, and I am not afraid to say raise money. We need to do this. I hear it all the time from secular people. Well, I don't want to tithe. I don't want to be involved with that. Oh, but you don't mind if the religious right takes over our country. I don't like that politics is so intertwined with money. I don't like that advocacy is so intertwined with money. But I'm just reporting here that's the way it is. And we are either going to get involved and organize ourselves to change this country in a pragmatic way, or we are just spinning our wheels, and I don't want us to spin our wheels. I think that we can do this, and I'm ready to work with you. I will use my experience, 2 years lobbying in my state, 2 years lobbying at the federal level, my political experience to come to every single state of this union, do a grassroots training, and talk about organizing. We need to get this done. That is critical that we do so. And then, at the Richard Dawkins Foundation, we are going to have innovative organizing on a national level, on a national level to change what's happening in this country. And I want to go through each piece of how we'll have this innovative organizing. One is richarddawkins.net, 1 million hits a month at our website. When you want to organize your statewide coalition, we are unveiling a new website in just a few weeks. It's going to be a really souped-up website that's going to take it from 1 million hits a month to an increase. And so when you organize your statewide group, you can connect to our website if you choose, have that umbrella so that you can run and you can be the leaders for it, but you can get all the hits from other people who happen to be from your state who already visit our website. Next, we have the Out campaign. How many people recognize this symbol? Okay. This symbol was the idea of our executive director, Dr. Elizabeth Cornwell, who's an evolutionary psychologist. She got resistance when she first proposed the idea, and now there is a Facebook page for this Out campaign for the nation of Afghanistan. This is a fantastic change. And for the Afghani people who have that, who may be a small minority, but they're not the ones who are cutting off people's noses. They're not the ones who are telling women how they have to dress. They're the ones who are speaking for justice. It is an important thing to do and very valuable. Another innovation is the clergy project. The clergy project is for, as we've heard about, people who are in the clergy. And one of the best ways to educate yourself about religion and educate yourself out of it is to know the Bible well, and this happens with many in the clergy. We offer a safe haven with our organization and our website for these folks. It continues to grow. You may know of people who want to participate, and we provide security and confidentiality where people want that. And it really is a compassionate thing. If you started out in life where, you know, you've got your degree from a Bible college, and that's the career you had, and you're 40 years old, and you've got two kids, where do you go when you come to find out you don't believe what you've been preaching? We offer a safe haven for that, and it's critically important that we do. Similarly, for secular parents, this can be a great challenge for parents. A lot of times the direction is the other way, where people say as soon as they have kids, well, we're starting to send them to Sunday school. What about secular parents? The website provides a home and a place where people can meet and organize around those issues, and you'll see that in our new website. These unique communities, African-Americans, Latinos, ex-Mormons, ex-Muslims, these are folks, they will be taking the lead, not us at the Richard Dawkins Foundation, but each of these communities taking the lead themselves, but we provide that umbrella and the million hits a month so they can congregate more people into their efforts and the unique challenges that they face as an organization. Speakers as organizers. We have great speakers with the Lou Apignani speaker series. We have people like Dr. Andy Thompson. Many of you may know him, who wrote the excellent book, Why We Believe in Gods. You can have these speakers there, but we're asking something of you in addition when we have speakers come to your community, and that is that we capitalize on this. We talk about organizing. We talk about you building community. We don't just say if there's four secular groups in a city, we don't say, well, just only invite the one group that invited us originally. Let's invite all the secular groups and maybe additional people as well. Let's expand our circle and expand our horizon. That's what the United Core has done. We work hand in hand with them at the Richard Dawkins Foundation and want to continue to do that. So these issues, innovative issue framing, like I've talked about, innovative organizing, and then third, unparalleled catalyst in your state. And this relates to Richard Dawkins and those 2,300 people who showed up at Eastern Kentucky University. You might want to have Richard Dawkins come to your community, and he's been extremely generous about doing that. But we need to be more strategic about the use of Richard Dawkins and the fact that he's being generous with his time. What is the long-term building capacity when he comes to a community? It doesn't make sense to have Richard Dawkins, for example, come to a community, have 2,000 people show up, and then they walk away without retaining all the emails. How can that happen? But I've seen it happen. We're changing that at the Richard Dawkins Foundation. When folks come and say, hey, we want to have Richard Dawkins come speak in our community, we're going to start to say, great, fantastic. What is the long-term plan? How are we going to make this capitalize on change? Building that statewide organization, what is your plan to get that done if you want to have Richard Dawkins come to your community? And building resources for your community, by which I mean, I'll translate that, I mean money. How are you going to build an effort so that when, if Richard Dawkins were to come to your town, you end up with not only more people involved, but also you end up with more money in the bank for your secular organization, which our foundation would be willing to work with you on. We need to raise money at the Richard Dawkins Foundation. It's very necessary. But I hope that everyone in this room, whether you're a student or whether you're that millionaire, there is some millionaire here, right, please? But whoever you are, anywhere in that spectrum, I'm asking you now to take out your checkbook and really say, I'm going to invest in the local secular groups here in this community. Give them money. Give them money to the local United Core, to the secular organizations, to the student organizations. Help them succeed. We need help at our national organization, but it's critical that we build that local infrastructure. And the key is that you lead. The Richard Dawkins Foundation can do a lot, and we have big plans that I've outlined for you, but are you going to organize? Are you going to create that statewide web presence? Are you going to raise money? That is key for me. You know, I talked at the beginning about Thomas Jefferson, and I really admire Thomas Jefferson, but, you know, he was tall and handsome, and the women kind of dug him, you know. But his partner was James Madison, and he was short and kind of awkward. He was my guy. Really, I liked Madison, and Madison really, he was there when Jefferson was off in Paris, you know, charming everyone. Madison was back, getting that separation of church and state here in the U.S. into that Constitution, making sure the nuts and bolts were in American law to provide for that protection. And the compassion of Madison really rings through to today. One thing that Madison said, and I want to quote it to you, he said, "It is of great importance in a republic not only to guard society against the oppression of its rulers, but to guard the part of society against the injustices of the other parts of society." That is, that when you have a faction that can unite a stronger faction and oppress the weaker. He spoke out then for protecting the rights of the minority against the tyranny of the majority. And so there is no better city, more nobly named, in my view, than Madison, Wisconsin. Is this... This place really speaks to a deep and great value for our country, and one that I think really is transformational for the entire world, because Jefferson and Madison were kind of the Lenin and McCartney of governmental thinking. They were the ones who really got us there. And I do want us to think about what Wisconsin's own Gene Wilder at least speaks to. It's actually a quote from an Irish poem, but my favorite line in Willy Wonka, "We are the music makers, and we are the dreamers of dreams," is my favorite line, except for one other, "So shines a good deed in a weary world," which is my favorite line. And you need to do it. You need to be the ones who have those good deeds. And so to make that happen, this checklist, make it something that's important to you personally. You know, when I was in the Maine legislature, they would do prayers like they always do at the beginning of the session, right? And so one time it ended up where they ran out of time, so they asked politicians to do a prayer. So I got called up to do a prayer. And my prayer was, I quoted Susan Jacoby's Free Thinkers, and I quoted that free thinker, Walt Whitman. And for me, Walt Whitman means so much. And I think if you were to take these actions, you yourselves, you who are watching here in this room and those watching online, to say, I'm going to directly participate in this. I'll be there with you, devoting my life to this. But I think with those actions, we can do what, as Whitman said, is to make of our own lives a great poem. And there's nothing better than that. I hope you will all get involved. I'll be there with you. Thank you very much. What's your,